Welcome to Season 13 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go! Welcome back. I'm excited you're here. You joined us for the right episode. This week, our featured guest is Mike Irwin, and it's probably one of the most powerful discussions we've ever had on the podcast. I met Mike in person to do a live recording of the podcast in Pinehurst. He's a decorated military man, one stint in Iraq, two in Afghanistan. He's a West Point graduate. He's married, four kids, 38 years old. He's constantly giving of himself and to help other people improve. He's got his own company, started two nonprofits, he's helped found a high school. He's just a doer, and he's a guy that I respect a great deal, and I think there's absolutely things that each one of us can learn from Mike and his experiences and his stories that he tells in this week's episode. Specifically, we cover a topic that we haven't covered much of, and that is Leading Yourself First, which is the title of his book, but it really centers around solitude and spending more time in thought for yourself in order to solve problems and then effectively lead other people. So without further ado, here is one of the best conversations we've ever had with my friend, Mike Irwin. Mike Irwin, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Really excited to engage in all these ideas that we talked about already.
You have a decorated background, yeah. Really. Once in Iraq, twice in Afghanistan, served the U.S. militarily. Yep. You've now gotten into various projects, particularly around leadership development in various forms. Let me start by saying thank you for your service.
Absolutely. I always respond to people all the time saying it was a huge honor to serve. The opportunity to go downrange and to see some of the worst of the world, but also some of the best. To be able to do it on behalf of the country is one of the greatest honors of my life. So,
where does your, after you get out of the military, how old are you?
So I was 35 years old.
35 years old, you transitioned out of the military. Yep. Did you know exactly what you wanted to do when you transitioned out?
No way. For me, a bit of the journey starts back in grad school when I studied positive psychology and leadership at the University of Michigan. And I knew I wanted to do something with positive psychology as I transitioned from the active duty to the reserves, but I wasn't sure what. I knew, though, that it had to have something to do with how can I take my knowledge of positive psychology, and specifically because I studied under the co-founder of the field, and take that knowledge and turn it into something that could hopefully scale and make a huge impact across the country over time. I just didn't know what that looked like, and I'm sure we can get into it a little bit later, but that opportunity really found me. So, huge believer in, call it fate, divine intervention, whatever you will, but like a guy that I went to, I grew up with playing basketball with, and someone else that I played baseball against, they were now a principal and a teacher in a school in New York, and they reached out and said, hey, what's this positive psychology stuff, and can we start teaching it to kids? And it was really through them that this new mission that I'm on right now with the Positivity Project found me. So,
while we're on the subject, what is positive psychology? We don't have to go too deep because, but most people think positivity, psychology, I get the two words together.
Yeah.
But why did these two men want to teach it to kids?
Yeah. So I think that when you think about positive psychology, I break it down as simple as this. It's the study of what goes right in life. So specifically, it's psychology has traditionally been the study of what's wrong, deficiencies, problems, evil, hatred. And positive psychology says, while we can't neglect the problems and the challenges of the world and with people, we also can't forget that we need to explicitly study what goes right. And that around, where I come from in the positive psychology world is it's a focus on character. Each person, no matter how good, or bad they may seem to be, has character. And they have these positive character traits within them. And for me, that's what it's really been about, is how do we maximize and get more good character out of people, because it has this cascading effect on relationships, on experiences, and ultimately on how we build our communities and our country.
We define character as the mental and moral qualities distinctive to an individual.
Yep.
Being the fact that you're a military man,
yeah,
and now you're, you know, fully entrenched in the positivity project and teaching this to kids. When is our character developed?
So I think that this is obviously a debate that rages,
right,
between psychologists, and some people sort of say it's very fixed by age 18. Or, you know, I'm really a huge believer that it's never really truly fixed. I think that certainly starting from a very young age, even before children are conscious of what's going on around them, they're learning and they're picking up on examples of forgiveness or integrity or gratitude or humility or hope around them. But they don't really start to, you know, until they can learn it. You know, that's when they start to internalize it, just like anything else, like learning how to add, learning how to read and write. Those are tangible skills. Well, when you think about character, it's something you also have to learn. Like, what does it mean to have integrity? What does it mean to have gratitude? So I think that it truly starts in earnest in about kindergarten, first grade. But I also really believe it's an ongoing process throughout life. I think that our character can and does change significantly at moments in our life when we hit inflection points, be they intense adversity, like we lose somebody or someone gets sick, or we change careers, or we, you know,
have a baby
or become empty nesters. These big, right, moments in your life, I think they absolutely force you to be more open-minded, or to be more grateful, or to show more humility, to be more creative. There are moments in our life that force that out of us. And when we find ourselves in that current, I'm a huge believer that it does alter our character strength profile. Maybe not forever, but certainly for a good pocket of time. For sure.
How much, just in terms of the positivity as you relate it back to your time in the military,
yeah,
how important is positivity in leadership specifically? Because certainly positivity in life's important. How do you think about positivity as it relates to leading people or leading other people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I know it's something that, you know, John Gordon has written extensively and talks a lot, right, about. It's something that I've been obsessed by since 2009, once I started working on my thesis in grad school, which looked at the intersection of character and leadership, right? That's exactly what it was. We looked at leaders in combat situations who are facing a lot of adversity. And some of them, it was a leadership problem around people. Some of it was a firefight and they're being attacked. Some of it, you know, so there's a whole bunch of different challenges that they wrote about to prime them to think about the challenges that they faced. And so coming back to the role of being positive, and so I think specifically about the character strength of optimism and how important that character strength is to leadership. And of all 24 character strengths, I believe that in the world today, that there's a couple that are
more important.
Yeah, I think uniquely important. One of them is integrity, right? In this increasingly transparent world we live in, to be somebody different behind closed doors than when you're out in front of the people you're leading, that used to be a lot easier to compartmentalize. And I think that the world now is becoming increasingly transparent and you can't do that. So integrity is really, really important. I also think that, you know, optimism and this idea of being a positive leader, we, once again, in this information age, and we write about this in Lead Yourself First, but, you know, one of the downfalls of this information age is we're aware of so much information. And so I think a lot of people are now aware of a lot of the ills of the world and a lot of the challenges that they read about on social media, or they read about in the news so often, that it has made it harder for people to be more optimistic about other people and about the challenges of the world. And so to be an optimistic leader who is relentlessly positive in the face of challenges, I think that's a true competitive advantage in the world today, even more so than just 5 or 10 years ago. And you see it show up in our politics. You see it show up in the media. It's just, it's everywhere right now. There's such a strong appreciation for negativity and cynicism that a lot of people just, that's their go-to. And even on social media, we post things often that are going to make people angry. And it's why? Because it drives virality. Things that get shared the most are things that make us mad. So people, they so readily pull that card out of anger and cynicism and negativity that ultimately leadership is about being positive in the face of those challenges.
I want to get into the book because there's some really key things. But before we do, on this idea of positivity, someone that's not, you know, whether it be from their childhood or their parents or whatever it may be, that just tend to have a little bit more gray look on life. Yeah. You know, they kind of look at it from a glass half full perspective. Yeah. Can somebody like that change?
So that's a great question. And it's one that I've actually explored even in my own personal life. My brother is 3 years younger than me. He went to West Point like I did. He deployed to Iraq like I did. Very similar sorts of trajectory. And he actually used to nickname me Opti, as short for optimism, you know, O-P-T-I. He's like, dude, you're always just so optimistic. You're so positive. You know, I was that guy playing golf, and I'd slice it into the other fairway. And before I was even leaving the tee, I'd already convinced myself that I meant to do that, and I had a better angle at the flag, like literally. And you know, people used to make fun of me for that, but like that's the way my brain is hardwired to immediately look for the good opportunity that might emerge, even from that adversity or that. Well, there's still some good in that situation. And my brother tends to be more on the side where he's had to be more deliberate about it, had to work at being more optimistic because he does tend to fall more on the Eeyore side of life. And I think that, you know, if you were to sit here and interview him, he'd say, look, at the end of the day, Mike is still more optimistic. His character strength profile makes it easier for him to see the good in just about everything and everyone. But he's made significant progress that I've noticed out of him since graduating from West Point. You know, we were at West Point together when 9/11 took place. I was a senior. He was a plebe, a freshman, you know, and things changed for us both real quick, like in the snap of a finger, and then for our entire family. Because of that, because both my sisters went on to marry West Point graduates. So it's a
big deal.
Yeah. I mean, at one point my parents had two sons and two son-in-laws that were like basically either deployed or, you know, like on the verge of deploying, you know? So it goes back to this idea though, that you can work on it. We know from the research that you can bolster your optimism. You can train and reprogram your brain to look for the good in situations and to be more positive. At the end of the day, I think you can only improve so much, but for sure it involves doing things like listening to podcasts that help you to frame things better. It's about reading books about positive leadership and about learned optimism and Martin Seligman and John Gordon and people who obsess about this and write about it. So I do believe there's a lot of room that a person who's not happy with where they're at can move the needle for themselves on this one.
I love it. I think about that a lot too. I mean, and how important it is, even down to the belief, like a leader, let's take an organizational leader for a minute, right? How much belief, positive, optimistic belief they have in the people that they lead right out of the gate. I've seen a lot of leaders that really struggle with, they almost think the worst in their people versus starting with a very positive outlook about what this person's capable of. They almost set like a limit on their people's potential because either they're not them or they're not like them. And I think having that mindset of starting each and every day, or if you're moving into a new role, like this team that I get to influence, that I get to make an impact on, that I get to touch the lives of, they have a bigger ceiling than I do.
Yeah.
Why don't more leaders think like that?
Yeah. It's you know, I think the short answer is that people are complex. And something you just said I think is so important, and that is that we often look for people who are like us. We know that, you know, diversity of ideas and diversity of experiences is a good thing, but so often when we look to people, we end up looking for reflections of ourselves, you know, or I'm looking for people who are going to see the world just like I do, you know, and this happens in our marriages, it happens in our friendships, it happens in our workplace and on teams that we're a part of. And I think it just boils down to the fundamental notion that humans are very complex. We've got different backgrounds, we have different personality traits, we're raised differently, we have different opinions, we have different religions, we have
come from different places, yeah.
Everything. And we're so different, and to find alignment is, it's almost like a needle in a haystack to find people who like would see things just like you. And so because of that, it's a consistent challenge, I think, for us to be able to see and appreciate those differences in people as being a good thing. And this is, once again, when we think about the character strengths profile, why character strengths like perspective and open-mindedness are so important, because it's that emphasis that You need to be open to other points of view. You need to put yourself in somebody else's shoes, but it's not natural for 99.8% of us.
Well, let's get into the book, because I've actually, everyone that I've talked to or interviewed, I haven't actually always had the opportunity to read or listen to their entire book, and I actually got the opportunity to do that with yours. Tell me a little bit about why this book for you, and maybe why now.
Yeah.
It's called Lead Yourself First.
Yep. Lead Yourself First, Inspiring Leadership Through Solitude. So just a little bit of the background and the story that, you know, most people just don't really know about. So back in 2010, I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, and my brother-in-law was also there getting his JD MBA. He was clerking.
You guys just follow each other around.
It's a little bit crazy. He was clerking for a federal appeals judge named Ray Kethledge. Right there, the chambers were right downtown Main Street, Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I literally had just turned in the paperwork to found Team Red, White, and Blue in March of 2010. My wife was 39 weeks pregnant with our first kid. And I run into Johnny, my brother-in-law, and Ray out there having lunch on Main Street. And we started talking about a whole bunch of different things and just getting to talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. Because I was, at this point, I'd only been back from Afghanistan for about 9 months. And so that was still so fresh in my mind. And I'm studying positive psychology, and I just decided to create this nonprofit organization. And we started talking about this article that I had read. It was actually...
Tell the mission of Red, White, and Blue while we're on the subject. Just people might not be familiar with it. Just, we don't have to go deep, but just look at that mission statement. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, so our mission is to enrich the lives of America's veterans by connecting them to people in their community through physical activity. So it's basically helping veterans to transition from that full-time service mindset to now you're out in the civilian world, to meet new people and to stay active, because very often one of the first things veterans do when they hang up the uniform is stop exercising, because the military used to make you do it. So that's
maybe
our mission.
Maybe start drinking. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you start to think of like all the bad things that can come from that. So we're trying to keep the focus on wellness and on relationships and on physical activity.
Good.
So I just founded that organization, and a talk was given in the fall of 2009 at West Point, where I was preparing to go back and become a teacher, by a guy named Bill Dershowitz, and he turned that talk into an article, and it was called Solitude and Leadership. That's it. That was the title of the article. And someone sent it to me. This was in the days when Facebook was very nascent, so I didn't see it on Facebook. It wasn't going viral. It was one of those...
Friend said you...
Exactly. It was a distro. Like, people were pushing it out. Hey, read this article. I pushed it out to around 40 of my friends. And never before, and I did that, you know, about once, twice a week, I'd send out, hey, I think this is a really good article. You know, again, pre-Facebook, posting things on LinkedIn or on Instagram or Twitter. It was the way that we shared information, was through email. And I never got such a strong response. Number one, almost everybody read the actual article, and it was pretty long. It was about, you know.
I sense that's my wife. She doesn't read, so yeah. I get it.
Exactly. So, like, this is the reality of the world, right? And so it's a seven-minute read. Read it. And the amount of positive feedback I got was incredible. So I actually reached out to Bill Dershowitz, who at the time was a professor, assistant professor at Yale. And I said, hey, just, you know, like, this is incredible. And I don't know what kind of reaction you got at West Point, but the response from my friends, who are really incredible leaders, has been amazing. And I think you should write a book on it. And he kind of came back and said, hey, you know, I'm already working on another book, but if it's something you believe in strongly, you should work on the book.
Cool.
And so I had that conversation with Judge Ray Kethledge right there over lunch. And I talked to him about this article, and he was fascinated by it because as a judge, you know, he would retreat to his camp up in northern Michigan on one of the Great Lakes and write his opinions and do things like that. And he realized how important it was to him. So at that moment, like, we started going back and forth, and by June of 2010, we agreed, hey, let's work on this book together. Let's leverage our strengths. Mm-hmm. Ray is one of the best writers that I've ever met.
He's very, very, very talented.
And he's the one who put fingers to keyboard on all those words. And I did a lot of the structuring around the interviews and coordinating with that. And we did a lot of the analysis together. So it was a true team effort. And so that was the beginning, you know, of it. But I'll tell you, like, any journey, like anything, the amount of perseverance needed to bring it to life was incredible. I'm by far the most proud of that. It took us 7 years from the time we started writing it until we turned in the final manuscript. And that's a long time to be working on this project. That's a lot of...
I mean, you had four kids in that period.
Founded two nonprofit organizations in that period. You know, four moves. I was in Michigan, New York, Florida, and back to North Carolina. So a lot of stress going on in that moment. And one of the things people ask is, well, geez, like, how, when do you get your solitude? It doesn't sound like, I'm like, exactly, not very often. I have to work at it and be deliberate. So anyways, that was the story and the origin of the book and why we decided to write about it.
Well, what I found was interesting, and it's not an area that we've covered a ton, which is this idea of how important solitude is in leadership. For people that haven't studied solitude, just give us what is solitude. Let's start right there, because I think a lot of people are just not sure what solitude is. And then once we know what it is, why is it so important from a leadership perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think solitude is an evocative word. You hear it and people think, like, they've got some, most people have an emotional reaction to it. And so, you know, we'd really define solitude as a subjective state of mind where the mind isolates itself from the input from other minds, with a follow-on definition and add-on to that of so that you can work through problems and challenges on your own. And so you can be on top of Mount Rainier, but if you're reading your Twitter feed, right, that's not solitude. You can be on there by your own, you know, physically. The next person can be 5 miles away and you can be so far away, but that's not solitude as we define it. And at the same time, you could be in a coffee shop or in some place in a lobby on your own, you know, with noise-canceling headphones on or not, right? And just completely isolate yourself from everything going on and be working on a challenge or working on a paper. And we even define solitude, you know, as like when you're reading a book, right? That's not solitude. But when you stop and you think through the application of that, or you listen to a podcast, right? That's not solitude in the moment. But if when the podcast is over, you shut it off and you think about the applications to your life, that's solitude, right? So it's really, how can you, with all the noise of the world, with all the inputs of the world, with all the information that just continues to bombard us, I believe it's the recent estimates are that the human brain today processes about 6 times as much information in a given day as it did 30 years ago, right? So just the amount of things coming at us is just far greater than what it used to be. So our argument is that more important than ever, this idea of solitude and isolating the mind and finding disciplined ways to do that is absolutely imperative.
Now, which is fascinating. I mean, in our instant gratification world that we're in right now, I mean, the thought or the idea of making intentional time for solitude. And in the book, you tell some incredible stories about Grant and General Lee when the Civil War was going on, and how General Grant would take time. Just examples like that where you would never know it, that these great leaders were taking time for solitude and thought. Not with, there's certainly a time to have a table full of your executive leadership team and come up with ideas. But there's also a time for you as a leader or me as a leader to be completely by myself with my own thoughts.
Totally.
Did I get that right?
No, totally. I mean, I think that, and the way the world used to be without all the noise, you know, it used to be easier to do that, right? So we profile Eisenhower in there as another example. Big extrovert.
Well, I actually I actually wrote this down, okay? Yeah. Eisenhower's definition of leadership. Leadership is the art of getting someone else to get what you want done because he wants to do it.
Yep.
Which I thought was a little fascinating because it feels a little coercion going on, but I get it.
Yeah.
You know? And I didn't, and I had no clue how great of a leader he was.
Yeah, I mean, he is, you know, when you look at it objectively, right, so one of the 5 5-star generals in U.S. history, 2-term president, but then also a lot of what he's able to do as a leader even beyond that, like in how he shaped and influenced things. So, I mean, he's just an amazing example. Of course, I'm also partially biased because he's a West Point graduate. You know, like Ulysses S. Grant, you know, both West Point graduates.
Why don't we just keep naming all the famous West Point graduates?
But I think that it really gets to this idea of that it used to be a lot easier to do that. But even someone like Eisenhower, he had lots of meetings, right? He was a big politician. He was a huge extrovert. He loved meeting with people. But he got to points where he's like, damn, I just need some space to be able to calm my mind down and think. And he also had to be a politician, though, right? He had to meet with admirals and generals from the various, you know, from the UK and from all the different allies. And he was also dealing with, you know, Marshall and everything going on back in the Pentagon. And so there's just was so much going on that to see a leader who had the enormity of making the decision of do we go or not on June 6, 1944, like you think about the stakes of that decision versus the stakes of do we open this new line of business or
right.
you know do we make you know do we recruit this person or not, you know, the level of gravitas of the leadership decisions that he had to make. And it's not saying anything or, about every other decision, but like it's just, you know, you're talking people's lives and, oh, by the way, large numbers of them. You know, the amount of...
And like the histories of countries. I mean, we're talking about like
yeah.
the future of countries yeah. for years to come.
In Vicksburg, you know, with Grant and, you know, like what he did, he completely just crazy idea. Like, we're going to live off the land for 5 months. We're going to, you know, instead of crossing the Mississippi River here, we're going to go south and then we're going to go across and we're going to live off the land. I mean, those things happen, I think, very often in solitude. And what we found when reading is that, you know, you don't, it's not like there's this plethora of examples of when leaders use solitude, because it's, even if it's an autobiography, you don't sit there and say, oh, I went into solitude and I thought about this and that, because you can't remember it, right? It's just this process that you get immersed in. So there's not a whole lot of first, you know, first resource examples out there of how this happens. We worked really hard to read tons of books. Like, and there's lots of leaders that we read about that we know they use solitude, people like Margaret Thatcher, but we couldn't find it in the biographies on her of when she used it at a critical time. So again, the powerful stories you saw, like a Pope John Paul II and Martin Luther King Jr. and Jane Goodall, those are some incredible examples, but there's a lot more out there yeah. that the world just never knows about. And our hope is that in writing this book, we can make people more aware of those moments so that they become aware in their own story as a leader, the role that solitude played at that critical juncture.
Yeah. So I would be doing our audience a disservice if I didn't ask, how do you make solitude, regardless of your leadership role, even if you're just leading at home, let's say
yep.
you don't lead anybody at work, but you have a wife or you have a husband and you have kids. How do you create a practice
yeah.
for more solitude? And I'm going to make the cardinal sin of any yeah. interviewer here, but
yeah.
Most people, you know, this idea of transcendental meditation and, you know, there's not any, I mean, it's everywhere right now. Mm-hmm. This person meditates and first thing
yeah.
in the morning
yeah.
and that's like the key to their life,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know? I think if I hear Tim Ferriss say
yeah.
meditation one more time,
yeah.
I'm going
to yeah.
lose it. I don't even know if anybody actually
yeah.
does it.
Yeah.
I think of meditation or time for solitude, at least for me, is prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a faithful Catholic
yep.
and Christian. So if I say a rosary or I, you know, kneel down in front of the sacristy and I just take time to listen to
yep.
God or a prayer.
Yep.
Is that solitude
yeah.
or does it happen when I stop those things?
Yeah, no, totally. I think that, and a lot of people we interviewed talked about the role of the interconnection between faith. We interviewed two ministers, Jimmy Bartz and Chip Eden. Chip is over in Charlotte and Jimmy's now out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, doing some hardship tour
right.
at a church out there. But we talked about that and the role and the intersection between faith, right, and spirituality. And solitude. So no, absolutely. I think that it's a place where a lot of people in adoration, they'll go, you know, in adoration for an hour of solitude and quiet. I think for a lot of people, they get their solitude from those moments. The classroom of silence, as Matthew Kelly calls it, you know,
right.
from Dynamic Catholic, he talks about this a lot. I think it is important that people realize that is a fundamental benefit of solitude that a lot of people get, is that if they are a person of faith, it's a time to kind of tune in, but that is absolutely solitude. And then going back to your point about the challenges, like in a busy life and how do you do it, like you're right, there's an overabundance of people out there talking about, you know, TM and meditation right now. We talk about it very briefly in the book, you know, by Bill George,
right.
you know, former CEO of Medtronic, professor up at Harvard Business School. But beyond that, we really talk a lot more about active solitude, so running, walking. I'm a big fan of like pulling weeds, you know, because I get a lot of them here. So like I'll go out and I just, that repetitive act of pulling weed after weed, it's a great place and a great time to just like let your mind wander. But for me...
Like mowing the lawn.
And mowing the lawn, exactly.
Right.
So there's all these opportunities that are out there when you can do it that doesn't require this deliberate, and frankly... it's hard to
create
get
a habit like that.
Yeah, to
yeah.
you know, to create that habit of, you know, being able to do meditation. It's not easy to do, first of all, but second of all, you know, it requires, you know, this extreme discipline to do that. Whereas I think that one of the points we make in the book is there's a lot of what we call targets of opportunity to practice solitude in your life. When your flight's delayed or you got an extra 20 minutes at the airport, you know, what do? Sometimes it's just sitting there and like looking out at the airplanes taking off and coming in and like and letting your mind wander.
Put your phone down.
Put your phone down and like and take advantage of those 20 minutes. Or when you have to drive somewhere, right? If you're not listening to a podcast, don't always have the music on. Don't always have a podcast on. Don't always, you know, have your deck stacked of people that you're calling, you know, for the entire 5-hour drive between, you know, here and, you know, Alpharetta. So find and schedule it in. And so that's my big takeaway for the audience is the best way that you're going to make solitude reality is, one, schedule it where you can. Two, train your mind to see those targets of opportunity when they pop up and seize them.
Oh, just love it, man. So, and I love the idea of instead of creating a brand, I know how hard it is to create a brand new habit.
Yeah.
But if you can implement it into things that you already do, you know, your chances of implementing it and being quiet and thinking drastically improve.
Yeah,
and I think that's incredible advice from you. Let's end on some fun stuff. You have 4 children.
Yep.
You are married.
Yep.
You lead multiple companies.
Yep.
You know, what's harder, leading at work or leading at home?
Oh, leading at home for sure. No doubt about it. I'm very suspicious of anybody who says otherwise, you know, because you're in close quarters with, you know, your people and everyone knows so much about one another and you add kids into the mix and you know, and their volatility and just their ability to just drive adults crazy, you know, it's no doubt at home. So
you get to give, you know, all of your experience from the military to West Point to writing books to working with companies to helping teach positivity in schools.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm almost like blown away with what you've done at 38 and the impact you're having on the world. So that's awesome. I'm proud of you.
I
really mean that with all my heart. You get to give one bit of advice to our audience. What's one lesson you've learned in your life that the first thought that comes to mind that you want to pass on?
I think the first thought that comes to my mind is really what's consistent with what I've learned through positive psychology and what we try to teach at the Positivity Project, and that is the power of your relationships. And that no matter how much you achieve, no matter how many gold medals you win, Super Bowls, how many millions of dollars you make, or whatever your job title is you aspire to, it's never going to truly satisfy you like good relationships can satisfy you. So, you know, I tell people, and sometimes it's not easy to hear that, but like if you've got a less than great relationship with your parents or with your siblings or with people that you grew up with, like those are things you should consider reaching out to people about and to try to mend or strengthen those relationships. And it doesn't have to be like a big forgiveness call or I'm sorry call, but if you can start to just slowly increase the pace of communicating. So at the end of the day, it boils down to the biggest piece of advice is never sacrifice all the success in the world and all the money and all the achievement for your relationships, and make sure that those relationships you have are something that you never let get too far out of like your priority lane. Because there is, when you're all in on something in a big project or you're deploying or you've got, you know, it's playoff time or whatever it is, it's very easy to lose sight of just how important those relationships are. And of course, as we know, no one's ever sits on their deathbed and says, you know, I wish I just made a few more bucks. You know, I wish I just worked a few more hours or started that company. It's the regrets that people have are always centered around, I wish I spent more time, you know, with people. And so it's really to never lose sight of how important those relationships that we have in life are to our well-being and to our impact on others.
I'm going to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
I just have to do it. The most important relationship I have in my life outside of my faith walk is with my wife.
Yep.
I love my kids to death.
Yep.
But 7 years, incredible partner, friend, you 4 kids. And what's this, your relationship with your wife meant to not only you, but now to all the work that you're doing? What role does she play in everything that you're doing?
Yeah, a big one, as you'd imagine.
And I don't know your wife. This is not a setup question.
No.
I'm just curious how, you know, for those of you that are out there that are married and, you know, sometimes we struggle with, do we pull that our spouse, man or woman, with us? Are they dragging us? You know, what is that like for you?
Yeah. So I think a big thing comes out of the military, right? Very often in the military, the culture has been like, you know, typically men, right? Because the military is mostly males throughout history are there. And then you have the supportive military spouse, right? Who helps, you know, to keep the house in order when, you know, you go off and deploy or you're on the field training for a month at a time. You know, our 10th anniversary is here next month. So we got married right here at Sacred Heart 10 years ago. And so I've actually been doing some reflecting on just that, you know, and we also had an interview with a magazine just recently talking about our relationship and all that. Currently, right now, we actually kind of work together on this initiative. You know, we're two of the seven founding board members for a Catholic high school right here in Southern Pines called Father Capodanno High School. And so I've gotten to see her leadership, her passion, like up front. But, you know, in those really those 6-7 years when I was on active duty as a major in the Army and founding Team Red, White, and Blue, and that's consuming me for 30, 35 hours a week and just so much of my creative and leadership energy. And then seeing the moves that we had to make and doing all that kind of stuff, you know, it's clear that we all know, we all joke about how spouses, you know, they really know how to, like, you know, push each other's buttons and all that. But I'll tell you that that stress is as long as you have this mindset, stress is a good thing for your relationships. That's what allows, you know, as we know, like, iron gets, you know,
iron sharpens iron.
Absolutely. And the hotter the fire, the stronger the steel, right? And I think that when you go through adversity and you move 4 times in 7 years and you have kids and you're not getting a lot of sleep in the night and you're doing all that, like, as long as you take into, you know, and you're creating a nonprofit and then another nonprofit and then a school and you're doing these things, I think it's important to remember that, like, all the stress that comes with that, so long as it's not like stress around like your physical health, right? If you got your health, physical health, all that other stress together, my mindset, my wife's not quite as much as mine, but right. but close is like, we kind of welcome that stress and say like, hey, we're here to serve. We're here to make a difference. And that means, yeah, we don't do a whole lot of date nights. We don't get to do as much fun stuff as we might like to, but in the long term, we know that we're making a huge impact on other people, and that to me is more important than going to watch a movie every single Friday night, or, you know, getting out and going out and playing as much golf as I'd like to, or doing those kinds of things. So
there's a priest in Charlotte that's made a big impact on me, and I'll never forget these words when they came out of his mouth. He looked at me dead in the eyes and he said, "John, you know what marriage is all about, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, yeah, of course."
Yeah.
And he said, "No." He said, "Marriage is all about helping your spouse get to heaven."
Yeah.
And those words have always stuck with me. And, you know, I hope to our audience, whoever you're married to out there, that you're helping your spouse get to heaven. And Mike, we really appreciate you coming on. Where can people learn more about what you're doing, get involved, find out more about you?
A whole bunch of different places just because of the different organizations, but the easiest places are, you know, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Erwin, RWB, so for Team RWB. I'm on LinkedIn, you know, under there, Michael Erwin. And then, you know, my page is characterleadership.center is the
website. Characterleadership.center. Yeah. Well, we'll make sure to link this all the right places. But, thank you so much for coming on the show,
absolutely,
man. Thanks for all you're doing.
Yeah, appreciate it. Great chance to talk about this stuff, John.
Thanks for joining us on another week of the show. If you like this, do me a favor and share it with a colleague or a friend, or leave a comment, review, and recommendation wherever you listen to podcasts. Anything that would help us spread the message of leadership, it would mean a great deal to me in my heart. Until next time, be a good leader at work and at home.